Happy New Year, Forkies. Happy New Year, Amy. I hope 2024 has been treating you so well so far. This is such a really special episode for me. I recently got the chance to sit down with the director of the project I'm working on right now, Spring Awakening, at SLOC Musical Theater, the Schenectady Light Opera Company. And he was so fabulous, and it was such a great conversation. And if you love the show as much as I do, you're just going to cling on his every word, because he has just such insight, and it was such a beautiful way to talk about this show and to get excited for performances coming soon. So yeah, please enjoy. I hope all is well in Grand Forks, and we'll talk soon. Welcome, everybody. I have a very special guest with me here today. Not only are they actor, director, performer extraordinaire, but they are also my very first guest, formal guest on the podcast since moving to New York. Please help me welcome Brian Clementi. Yay! Hi, Brian.
Hi. Thank you so much for that introduction.
Oh my gosh. Of course. So, you are on the podcast today. We've made our connection because you are directing Spring Awakening at SLOC Theater in Schenectady, and I'm stage managing, which I'm very excited about. So tell me about your theater journey. Do you remember the first show you ever saw or did?
The first show I ever did, I was 11. Oh, actually, no. You know what? I was in second grade, and for whatever reason, my teacher put on, we rehearsed in class, and it was performed at we always did a morning program sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was themed around the 4th of July. It was very sort of Americana sort of thing, but yeah. I was a cat. You know, the way kids are often animals in shows and whatever. Yeah. I was a cat, and I had to sing Grand Old Flag.
And
I do not remember the. I remember there was a vendor. It was an. It was a little American thing, and uh-huh. But I don't remember when. Maybe it was around Memorial Day or Veterans Day.
Okay.
First thing that comes to mind is 4th of July, but obviously we're not in school then.
Right.
So I guess that was the first show I ever did. I was in second grade, and then really when I got into it again, we always had a big summer drama program at my school, and I was 11, mm-hmm. summer of 2001. We did the Nutcracker. So that was my first sort of big experience, doing the makeup and the costume, doing a big legit show.
Right.
First show I ever saw, I think it's either a toss up between, I remember seeing a local production at the Glove Theater in Gloversville of Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. I was probably around 5 or 6, and I remember little bits of it with my grandmother. And I also remember at the same time, again, bits and pieces of a production of The Sound of Music at Proctor's, mm. starring Marie Osmond.
Whoa.
So I remember hardly anything, but I remember sort of sitting there, and I remember eating M&Ms, and I remember her, but that was maybe four or five, I'm sure it was a fantastic tour.
That's wild casting. Yeah. I love that. So how did that lead to where you are now? Have you always done theater? When did you really get
the
bug?
Yeah, it was the Nutcracker.
Yeah.
That was sort of that first thing of feeling like you had found your people, or I had, found my tribe.
Yeah.
And I was never a sports kid, not that it needs to be either or, but mm-hmm. in a school system, many kids do sports as their sort of extracurricular, mm-hmm. and that's how they meet other people and that sort of thing. And I wasn't really into that. And so this summer drama program I signed up for on a whim, and there were 50 people in it, and they were all, so I was going into sixth grade. But there were people younger than I, and there were going up to I think ninth grade, you could be in it, maybe 10th grade. We had some older adults, but they were, mm-hmm. In high school.
Right.
And it was just it was an amazing experience. It was rehearsals, and we had to audition and things like that I hadn't experienced. So it was really the whole gamut, right? You get your exposed to everything right off the bat. And it was a legit, very serious thing. And aside from finding I was good at it and finding an outlet for sort of like, I'm obnoxious, not obnoxious, but like, well, I am obnoxious, but also, but like, I can be sort of outrageous and sort of like attention, sure, and that sort of thing. And then finding that there was a place for me in that sort of, yeah, world is, I mean, you know, that's what I say, like, they were bitten by the bug, right?
Right.
The theater bug. And then there was another sort of thing about, like, because we rehearsed all summer, and then that was September 11th happened that year, and we performed, it was, I think, we performed all summer. I think we did a show in the summer for, like, the maybe the parents or something, but then we performed when we got back in school for, okay, I think, the kids. And obviously September 11th happened in early September, and that was when schools were starting again. And I remember doing, like, getting back together to rehearse for a few days, but the atmosphere had changed so much.
Right.
And we added this sort of, like, patriotic finale, which, of course, had nothing to do with the Nutcracker, but it was very much one of those things of, it needed to be, like, it felt like there was an obligation need for right? And it was sort of, if I think back now, really the sort of first glimpse into how theater has this sort of power to heal and to do more than beyond just, like, entertain or fill some hours, you know?
Yeah.
The sort of larger power that theater has.
Yeah.
It was a long-ass answer to that question.
No, I love it. And no, I feel the same way when I started to do stage managing. Like, all my life I've been told I'm bossy or bitchy or whatever, and all of a sudden I start doing stage managing, and it's like, oh, those are actually great qualities to have in this position, because somebody needs to speak up and tell people what to do and keep everybody in line. So, yeah, totally feel the same way. Did you go to school for theater?
I did. So I'd always acted in, like, in my school. In my high school, at least, we only did one show a year. I know some schools do play and a musical. We only did a big spring musical, right? And directing was never a thing I was, guess, even aware of. Like, I wasn't even really aware of Broadway, I think, till I was, like, maybe in eighth grade, going into ninth grade. It was just something I had fun doing over the summer, and I liked the teacher, and I loved the people. And so that was just sort of, like, a fun little outlet.
Right.
And in high school, I started getting, like, larger parts, and it was so much fun, and I loved doing it and started taking it seriously. High school was also when I had my sort of, like, first directorial experience as well, which was a different sort of layer on top of it and something I also found I loved. So then I went to college, and it was always a plan, I think, to be, like, an English teacher and perhaps do drama at, like, a school, which was the exact situation that my drama teacher at high school was doing. She was an English teacher there, and she ran the drama department. And it was sort of a safe sort of thing because, you know, you need English teachers. You need those. And also, like, theater, obviously, not the most reliable job market,
sure.
You know, a lot of job security,
right.
A lot of job opportunities, excuse me. And so when I went to college, I mean, I do have an English lit degree, but I also have a theater degree, and I acted in a bunch there, but that's where I discovered, oh, people actually study this. And it wasn't like high school where I was just doing theater with whomever, people who wanted to do it for fun, people who wanted to do it for, you know, like everybody's doing it for a different reason, which is cool. In college, I started really doing theater with people who were there to study theater.
Right.
And it was a different level.
Yeah.
It just is. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is not a thing I can ignore. Like, this seems to be my calling.
Yeah.
And then after I went to, after I graduated college, I did, like, a traveling program for a little bit. And then I went to grad school. And so I have my MFA in directing at a school that I loved. I loved the area, and I guess it was a very unique experience in that I went to Stony Brook, and they had a satellite campus out in Long Island, out in the Hamptons. Stony Brook is on Long Island, and it was used to be Long Island University, but that had sort of become defunct, and then Stony Brook had brought that campus, and there was like a few things out there. They had a very prestigious like MFA in creative writing, and they were trying to get more things, one of which was this MFA in theater. Mm-hmm. And it didn't last very long after I left due to, you know, monetary reasons and, of course, arts things. And
sure.
Stony Brook, also a sort of a large medical campus and scientific campus. And so arts is just, you know, and it was, so I lived out there in Southampton for 2 years, year round, which in the summer it's wild, right? Because it's beautiful and everyone's there. In the winter, it's also wild, but for a totally different reason.
Right.
Because it's a ghost town and, you know, like, there's no one there.
Yeah.
And everything closes at 4 p.m. And you're like, what? But the people that I got to really study with and some of my professors were incredible. And so that's where I have my... And I got a lot of professional jobs out of that, which is exciting and really, you know, a main target of grad school, I think, in the first place.
Yeah.
So, yes, that's another long-winded answer, but
no,
yes.
I hope all of your answers are long-winded. I love it. How did you get into directing?
So, when I was... 16 yet? Probably not. When I was... My birthday's in June, so it was the end of my sophomore year of high school, and I was 15. Mm-hmm. And I remember mowing the lawn in our backyard, and my dad had recently, maybe like the summer before, or recently had built a like new deck in our backyard. We had a pretty big backyard mm-hmm. in our small little upstate, you know, quiet town. And I was like, oh... Well, that looks like, it looks like a stage. It did look very much like a stage. And I was like, I'm going to do something there. And I don't know what now, of course, as an adult, I'm like, what was I thinking? Remember when you were a kid and you're just like, anything's possible.
I'm just going to do this. Yeah.
I was totally, that was where I was, my head was. And I was like, this is what it's going to be. And we're going to do it. And I'm going to direct it.
Yeah.
And looking back, I don't know how, but all I can say is that after watching my director from high school, her name is Alicia Rich, Alicia Spraker, she's married, sorry, but she was Alicia Rich when I was there, and she's wonderful, and it was always just watching her, and she became a really good friend of mine. She was also my teacher and my drama director, and helped me through, so confidant, all those things, that mentor. And I was like, oh, I can do that. Mm-hmm. And not in a way that was like, oh, anyone can do it. But I mean is that I'd never had, I think, a belief in myself in terms of artistically. Mm-hmm. And she provided support. And I guess I never questioned it. I was like, oh, that's something that I could do too.
Yeah.
And I never questioned why. And again, now that I'm older and have anxiety, I'm like, oh God, what was I thinking? But when you're a kid, you're just like, what are we going to do? Like, I'm going to do it. We're going to, you know, like a Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney, like shows in the barn. You know, it's like that sort of thing. And we put on You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, mm-hmm. me and six of my friends. I was also Charlie Brown, which I know, the ego is insane. And it was like, could it be this little thing in the summer? And we rehearsed in the summer. And then we had 100 people in my backyard.
Oh, my God.
And it was sort of just, it was a truly bizarre experience looking back.
Yeah.
It was just sort of one amazing thing after the other. And I found myself... obviously loving to perform, but really loving watching it all come together mm-hmm. and sort of having an idea of what it wanted to say and sort of a different way to impact an audience and impact us as well, impact your actors.
Yeah.
Because it isn't, I mean, obviously the audience is experiencing one thing, but then your actors and team are with you through a different experience mm-hmm. as well as the final product. And so... it was, again, bitten by the bug, right?
Yeah.
And I was sort of hooked on that. And we ended up doing that. There was a boy in my town who, this was in the summer of my God, 2006. And in the spring, he was in a terrible accident. He was burned in a bonfire. And it was awful in every way, as one would imagine. But small town especially, and sort of just everybody knows everybody, and everybody knew him. And we ended up performing it at my local church hall the next, like, spring for, as a dinner theater benefit. One of my cast members, her mother and stepfather were chefs, and so they did the food portion, and we did Charlie Brown, which it was another one of those core memory experiences where it just, everything seemed to go right.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 200 people there in this church hall, and I remember, like, at the end, and we're doing happiness, and I remember seeing everybody, like, looking out, obviously, playing Charlie Brown, and I remember seeing everybody crying, and there was my drama teacher crying, and there was this boy who was burned, his mother, and he was in the hospital, obviously, for this whole time. I mean, he was in the hospital for a long, long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
He actually is doing very well now.
Oh, that's cool.
But it was, again, one of those core memories in the sense of, oh, theater has the power to heal. And I think I'd gotten a taste of that with the September 11th Nutcracker, but this was, like, the most affirming. If you were ever to tell me that that would happen, I would have been like, nah. But then because it happened organically, and I got to feel it and experience it, it was insane. Yeah. And that was, I think, what really sold me on the directing aspect of that. That I was able to sort of help guide others and an audience through that as sort of like the pilot of it all.
Right.
Yes. And so that's the whole, that's the directing sort of aspect.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite production you've been involved in?
I have several. Mm-hmm. As I was thinking about this question today, I realized that all of them, the ones that I really name as some of the best experiences, were just that, experiences that, whether I was an actor or a director, that a group of people really, really gelled and felt like a family, and it felt like we were creating something that had never been done before, and it was the perfect right moment for it. And you know, and it was hard to leave behind. Those are the other ones where, as an actor, some of the ones on stage where I just felt such an immense trust and able to let yourself go on stage with other people, were that production of Charlie Brown, certainly. In high school, I played Lumiere in Beauty and the Beast opposite my friend Mia, one of my best friends, and she was playing Cogsworth, and we had the most fun.
Yeah.
And when you're having fun and able to let go, audiences see that. Like, it transcends sort of the production, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you're not having fun, I mean, when you're able to sort of immerse yourself in a role in any sort of things, everyone sees that. It transcends. And in college, I did a production of Rent. I got to play Mark, which dream role, and one that I never, ever, ever thought would happen. And we were one of the first schools to do it after it had closed on Broadway.
Okay.
I think we were the second school in Western New York, third school in New York. It was something like that. And I got to play Mark, and it was the most amazing cast. It was a weird time of year. We do it in January when we performed when the students just come back to class. And so we went back right after New Year's, and we rehearsed for like 3 weeks before anyone else gets there.
Yeah.
And so you're just rehearsing all day. Like, it's a professional job, and you're and dorms weren't open, so we were all living together. Mm-hmm. And so it not that it's the, you know, obviously not the exact circumstances of Rent, but it bonded you in a way that was a huge plus in doing a show like Rent.
Absolutely.
the person who played Roger is one of my best friends, and that was another one where you just get to have an amazing time and feel yourself almost growing. Does that make sense? Like, as a,
absolutely.
When I did the Wild Party here at Slock, that was a huge experience, a great family sort of thing. And the same thing when I did Glorious Ones a couple years ago, which was November of 2021. And so it's a show I love, a not very well-known show. It's a show I love, and it's a show about making art and trying to make a name in art and just about creating art.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great cast. And what was more was that sort of outside circumstance of getting a chance to be back in a theater together after COVID,
mm-hmm.
a year and a half, and of just uncertainty and not even knowing how this was going to go day to day, right? And to be putting a show on about why art is so essential and how it stays with you was insane. Just another great experience. Professionally, I've assistant directed on some productions that were really, really great to behold. I worked on a production of All My Sons with Alec Baldwin and Laurie Metcalf, and again and Ryan Eggold. So Ryan was on the Blacklist for a while, and then he was just the lead in New Amsterdam for like the last 5 years. Another, when you get talent of that level in a room, it's just like a buffet. Watching them work is insane. Watching Laurie Metcalf work is just an extreme gift. So I have a bunch that I we're going to talk about it. Obviously, we're working on Spring Awakening now, but I just worked on a production of Spring Awakening at a different theater in March of this year. That was another one where it was a great group of people. Obviously, an emotional show, a show where people are willing to go there. Anyway, I guess that ties them all together is that these things of we bonded in ways that were more than just the show. There was this experience of feeling seen as a person, growing close to other people on a human level and not just, I'm working on a play, that this sort of thing.
Right.
And that's the common thread, I guess, with all of my sort of favorite ones.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite, just like a favorite show?
Ooh. I have two favorite plays, and they are Our Town, and the other one is called The Night Thoreau Spent in Jail, which is obviously not as well known as Our Town. and it's by Sherwood and Lee. And they wrote Inherit the Wind or Journey's End. Did they write Abe Lincoln in Illinois? So we're talking early 20th century. Yeah. And it's a play about Henry David Thoreau, who didn't pay his taxes for the Spanish-American War. And was spent a night in jail because of that, because he didn't believe in that. And and it's told out of time, I guess the same with Our Town. It's sort of very theatrical. I really enjoy shows that are theatrical. And it's just a great play about sort of his life and how he came to his philosophies and marching to the beat of your own drum. And I realize also that those two plays also, being from the Northeast, those two plays are also Northeast centered. He lived in Concord. This was in Concord, Massachusetts, is where Thoreau spent in jail. I'm realizing now that that's very. I feel very like I'm like, ah, these are my people. Yes. This sort of thing. Musical wise, It's so hard to pick one. I would say probably I will never, ever, ever get tired of Into the Woods. I think that's one of those shows that I could, if I had to direct one show forever and could do it different ways all the time, I think it would be that one. It just got such great material on one level, and then that deeper level is so fulfilling, I find. So I'm very much interested in sort of these darker themes that maybe we shy away from in life talking about, but in works of art, they're easier to digest, but still, I guess it's easier when you're seeing someone act it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of them. There's just so many. There's so many. I know what I don't like, which we're not going to talk about. But when I saw Great Comet also, that experience was...
Yeah.
The experience of... I got to sit on stage, and I only ever saw that once in New York, but that experience is one that I will remember forever.
Yes.
And I like shows that are able to sort of... You're able to experience them as opposed to watch them. They work so well if you're drawn in and you feel sort of attached, involved. I can't find the exact right word, but
yeah.
It's something you have to experience, not that you just see.
Yes. I remember when I saw Great Comet. I think I've talked about this on this podcast before, but like walking into the Imperial and the lobby was like very cement and like Cold War and lockdown. And then you walk into the theater and it's like, and it's all the red curtains and the chandeliers. And it was like, immediately I was sucked in. I was like, bought, paid for.
Did
you
sit on stage?
No, we sat in the last row of the balcony. So we were in traditional seats.
If you sit on stage, it's that thing, but more. Because you have to walk like through these like little hallways they have constructed backstage. And the whole thing was all that sort of like the sickle, you know, spray painted over all these sort of... truly plywood walls that they had constructed. And I remember walking on stage at one point and looking up, and you could see the chandeliers that were from the Imperial Theater that they obviously took down and added their own funky lights, but they were wrapped in plastic so that they didn't get dirty, but hanging in the sort of fly space above.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the most unique. And then, of course, you walk out and it's this decadent, opulent
you're in the world. Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So much. So, and the show hadn't even started yet.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I was like, I'm there. I'm buying it. I'm buying whatever you're selling.
Yeah, exactly.
I was so there.
And I got a pierogi, too.
What did I get? An egg shaker.
You got the shaker.
And then the pages of the books that they throw.
Oh,
so
yes.
I have like a book page. I have a shaker. It's something else that I got. I didn't get a pierogi though.
Yeah.
I like shows that remind us of our sort of place in the universe, or that hint at something larger. Something beyond, almost. I'm not a very religious person, and so I don't subscribe to a lot of those feelings, but that's something that, I don't know, I feel like art is a very close way to really reach someone. Or art is a very, to see someone, to reach someone. Art is one of the most impactful ways to do that. And those shows that sort of succeed on that level are ones that I'm really drawn to.
Yeah.
And want to work on. You know. Yeah. I mean, I love a fluff piece every once in a while, but those ones that are soul-searching and they sort of grab you and they can... Love that shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
speaking of dark themes, let's talk about Spring Awakening.
Good segue.
For those not in the know, give me a quick summary about what Spring Awakening is about.
Spring Awakening is based on a play written in the 1890s, and it is consequently set in the 1890s in a provincial town in Germany. And the play and the musical are pretty close in general theme and story. And it is about a group of children, 13, 14, very young adults, teenagers, who are growing up. And it is about their search for themselves, their search for connection. They are growing up in a society that is very strict and oppressive. And they are just trying to grow up and are finding a lot of that their paths for outreach are all shut down, whether they be because of religious beliefs or the whole town, the city, the government was very religious based, and that mm-hmm. sort of had some strict Lutheran. They're Lutheran. Mm-hmm. You got Calvinism going, a lot going on,
right?
Or because of personality or family stuff going on, the boys are in a sort of oppressive school system that just tries to churn out these cold. Everything is cold. They are the girls are being prepared to be wives. Boys are being prepared to go into academic, but you will learn what they want you to learn. Mm-hmm. And so you have kids going through really normal things. Questions about puberty, sexuality, exploration. People fitting in, people not fitting in, people dealing with maybe some hints of mental illness. Mm-hmm. And all of those are hard for them to explore. And in some cases they can't even do that. Yeah. And how they deal with all that.
Yeah.
The musical is very cool because all of the songs are mostly introspective,
mm-hmm.
and are rock and roll based and explode in bright colors because the world is everything but that. They have to move in sort of very rigid, lines and things like that, and are oppressed. And then in their minds, they can go wherever they need to go. And so much of it is based on feeling and not even specific storytelling. It's images. It's that, which is so true to life, right?
Yeah.
Nothing is, in our minds, we go everywhere and we're all over the place. And it isn't always logical. Feeling and emotion are often rub up against logic in a way that isn't super agreeable.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that's a little long, but it's the story of these kids trying to grow up in this time. And the adults who, for better or for worse, are hindering them from doing that.
Yeah. So, like you mentioned before, this is your second time directing the show. And for those who are familiar with the show, this version is very different. It's conceptual. So what made you want to return to the show with this vision?
When I returned to the show, I really was interested in, as I said before, a very theatrical approach,
mm-hmm.
where there are always people watching. By nature, the show itself sets up adults versus kids. That's just inherently in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to really go further with that and create these separate factions. And so what we've done with our set and sort of the way it's being staged is that they're kept totally separated. And there's one door that the adults sort of come go in and out of. And where that is, the kids aren't allowed to go. And the kids are sort of kept in one space for them to fend for themselves and to figure things out by themselves. And that's the stage that we see. We're obviously looking at the kids' point of view. And again, very theatrical. The kids are always watching one another. These behaviors that they're observing from the adults in their lives, from the other kids in their lives, they are fumbling mutely with their, they're searching for anything.
Yeah.
And so they're taking in everything. And their behavior patterns are being formed knowingly and unknowingly. So that was sort of the concept, the approach to this one that I really wanted to take was set up a hard line between the two of them, and really, really heighten that separation, and that when the adults come in, they're under pressure to do what they. I mean, the adults. Some of the adults are sort of do have malicious intent, but some don't, and that's a great thing about the show is that it shows that even if you are even if you're not trying to actively harm your children or lead them down a specific path, their behaviors, the things learned, can still have a huge impact on them.
Mm-hmm.
Again, for better or for worse. Everything is learned, and whether we mean to or not, or are fully aware of it, or it's more in our subconscious, we learn behavior patterns.
Yeah.
We are taught, and that's in most cases by our parents. Those are the people we live with, and in school's another thing. That's what, during our formative years, most cases, that's where people are, and that's where all the learning is done, and the harm can be done, and the amazing things can be done.
So, I've been a fan of the show for probably a decade now. I remember it's my freshman year of college. I remember very specifically, my iPod in, I was waiting for the bus to go to my evening class, listening to Mama Who Bore Me for the first time. It was like, it's like a snapshot in my head. And I was very into Spring Awakening and Rent at the same time. It's a very angsty time in my life. So I've known the show for a long time, and something you said at our first rehearsal really hit me in a way I'd never thought about before. You said the show is about cycles of trauma, and I thought about it about oppression and about living in an oppressive time, but the more I watch rehearsals and we dig into it, that is absolutely right. It's, you know, the cycles of trauma. And that one line that Taya has, and she says, how will we know what to do if our parents don't tell us, is really poignant and like really sums up the show. So how does that point of view affect your vision?
I mean, that line is the show.
That is the show.
That is the show. It may be even a little too pointed,
right?
But that is the show. Yeah. That's the message of the show. There are some who are sort of firmly believing that. There are some who are questioning it. And which one's the right one?
Yeah.
Again, if we are children and we're growing up and there isn't anyone to guide us and we can't trust those people whose job it is to guide us, who can we trust?
Yeah.
Where are the answers? Where do we go? I think that, you know, again, I actually, going back, I'm glad you brought up Rent as well, because before Spring Awakening came out and I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I've already mentioned that Mark was a dream role. Rent was one of those shows.
Yeah.
That was also just like, ooh, I have feelings, but I don't necessarily know what they are, but something in this is,
yes,
I am relating to.
Yes.
And when I saw Spring Awakening, for the first time, it was in like June, I think, of 2008. And I think I was like a week away from graduating high school. And I had just started to experience what would later become, you know, depression, but I had just started to experience change on a real level. Deep down, I was also dealing with coming out, which was a thing. But I remember watching that show and having such a visceral reaction to so many of the moments, but especially Don't Do Sadness and Blue Wind and the monologue before, at the end of the Don't Do Sadness scene before Left Behind. And I can now name it and know what it was. But at the time, I was like, I am being seen and I am so relating to this, but I don't know exactly why. I can't exactly name it yet.
Yes.
And now I have a therapist and now we do all that.
Yes.
But it was just another one of those that I was like, this was written for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was a casual fan for a long, long, long time until when it really came time to start working on it, on the previous version and again on this one. And I read the original play, which is brilliant in its own right. It's very different.
Yeah.
And I read sort of supplemental material. Steven Sater's book about how he wrote all the lyrics is a great one as well. And as I think also you get older, and you're not closer to those ages of you have more life experience and you're able to name things maybe a little better in your own journey, you do start to realize that, again, everything that we are is learned from somewhere. And we've either learned it because that was how we were taught, or we've morphed against it because we don't want to be how we were taught. We're trying to avoid something. And finding those out, so many of them are subconscious, right? Mm-hmm. And yes, this show is about the parents, the adults in their lives. Some are actively, maliciously oppressing the children, and that is due to feelings in their own things, maybe inadequate things, and then there are some who are trying to do what is right, but it comes up short in certain things, and it still leaves a lot of room for loneliness and searching and not finding anything. So I when I was doing this for the first time, I was like, oh, this is about cycles, and this is, you know, we are trying to start. I mean, that's what the Purple Summer is about. The Song of Purple Summer. It is separate from the play. The show ends, and then they have this sort of coda. Mm-hmm. And in his lyric book, Stephen Sater, and also in just looking at it, it is a song about a hope when hopefully one day we don't have to sing this song. Yeah. Things will be better. A time when the day will open up and you will get everything you've ever wanted.
Yeah.
And that's really what sells it. I mean, that's like that is the cycle of drama.
Yeah.
And I think the first step is when you have a cycle of, and I guess going back also, I mean, everything is traumatic, whether it is good or bad, right. There is still this traumatic thing. I mean, being born is traumatic.
Absolutely.
To our bodies. And our bodies remember things. And these children are dealing with so much here. Abuse, loneliness, mental illness, mm-hmm. Puberty, and sort of everything that brings with it, curiosity, sexual orientation. I mean, they are dealing things that people deal with. None of this is, you know, none of this is new. It is all stuff that we've always dealt with. They were dealing with it in the 1890s, and we're dealing with it today. Mm-hmm. And we are trying to get to a point. The kids are dreaming, are trying to get to a point of, you know, one day we won't have to have this. And that's the hope. And you know, we've made a lot of strides in terms of progress and understanding and empathy and acceptance in many years. But again, this was written in 1891 and it's 2023. And so that was 30 years ago, or excuse me, 130 years ago.
Yep.
And we're still telling
still
the
here.
Story.
Yep.
And we still need the story more than ever. And so, again, what better that just shows it more than anything, right?
Yeah.
Trying to break this cycle. We're all trying to do what we think is best for whatever reason. And sometimes we need to sort of step outside of us.
Do you have a favorite moment in the show?
The entirety of, for reasons I just said, the second scene in Act 2 between Moritz and Ilse,
yeah.
Doju Sadness, Blue Wind, and then they're sort of overlapping, is, I think, just a brilliant scene. It's brilliant in the play, their scene, and it's brilliant in the musical. The songs are brilliant, but they underscore that theme so well of loneliness and desperation, but that feeling of, I guess, let me backtrack and say that I find it very hard to express sometimes how I am feeling
mm-hmm.
into words. They often don't do it justice, or all of a sudden when I say it out loud, or this, it sort of it has things attached to it, has shame attached to it, has this, and words sort of fail in comparison to the whole feeling emotion, which is very well rounded. And that scene between the music, between the nuances, the unspoken language there, their actual dialogue, blocking, it all forms one very well-rounded scene of two people who need saving. And they are asking the other to save them in their own way. And then they feel shame about it. And then they feel that it's... And then ultimately tragedy happens. And I love that scene. I think it is so nuanced and, you know, you could work on it forever. And so lifelike. I mean, that is what life is, right?
Yeah.
It is shades of gray. It is not black and white.
Mm-hmm.
You are just watching two people who are a product of their circumstances feel like they are alone and clinging to that one thing. Just a little bit of hope that the other maybe can provide in that moment, all while sitting on the bank of a river at sunset. And you're there, right? Like, at least for me, I am there.
Yeah.
When I read that scene, when I see it out, when I see our two, you know, new actors, or our actors in this production doing it, it's just, I think, a great scene and really, really packs a wallop. And makes people feel, I guess, you know what? It always made me feel less alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge reason why I do theater, is if I can make anyone feel seen or a little bit less alone is a win. Whether that's an actor involved in the production, whether that's an audience member, or anyone involved in production, excuse me, it doesn't have to just be an actor or an audience member or whatever. I have felt less alone and that I matter because of theater, seeing, involved in. And so that's sort of my goal when I try to do it. And this is one of those moments in a show that is about that. I think really just reaches out and just grabs you. I love also Purple Summer for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
That we just talked about before, is that summing up of what has happened and the dream of something to come. Yeah. I love most of the show, but those are the moments that just, you know.
Yeah. So good. Okay. We're going to go to a lighter topic now. So anyone who has worked with Brian or even knows him have probably heard him use the phrase, "That's what my Grindr profile says." So in the spirit of that, we're going to play Fuck, Marry, Kill. But my grandma listens to this podcast, so we're going to call it Date, Marry, Kill, with some Broadway favorites. We have three categories. Our first is Broadway divas. So, Brian, date, marry, or kill Bernadette Peters, Patti LuPone, and Liza Minnelli.
I think... Give me a hot take. Ready? I think I would... I think I would date Patti LuPone.
Mm-hmm.
Because... what a story that would be, right?
Amazing.
Like, I feel like one date would be enough.
Mm-hmm.
And she would, like, yell at the waiter or, like, just yell about Andrew Lloyd Webber.
I hope
or something.
So, yeah.
I think I would marry Bernadette Peters.
Mm-hmm.
And I would kill Liza Minnelli. And that's, I feel like, a hot take. I mean, I think any one of those is a hot take, right? Like,
that's why we're here.
Whoever
you're
killing is a hot take. But,
yeah.
Like, I don't know. I've never... Liza is incredibly talented,
mm-hmm.
I think, but I've never been a Liza fan.
Sure.
So I would rather hang with the others.
There you go. Do you have a reason why you would marry Bernadette and not date her?
Yes, because I think I just feel like she is someone that I could get to know over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Patty, if I were to marry Patty, just feel like that she would leave. Or, like, you know what I mean? Like, she's around for a short time. Not a long time.
There you go.
You know. I do love Patty, though.
Yeah.
Patty. I love them both. I just...
Yes.
Bernadette is a more calming...
I understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Patty's intense. Which is why we love her,
not
right?
A calm lady. Yeah.
But...
There you go. My answers are similar, but flipped. I would date Bernadette because she's always got her boobs out, and I feel like that would be a good date.
Well, they are. They're often...
Yes.
Yes.
And I would want to get some curly hair tips from her. I would marry Patti LuPone because I worship Patti, and I would happily just be her housemaid or whatever she wanted me to do.
You know she's living with Aubrey. Have you heard the story about
she's her living with Aubrey Plaza right now?
Like, moved in with her while she's doing Danny in the Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah.
And they're just like, roommates.
Yeah.
Like,
heard she, like, Aubrey Plaza got strep throat or something, and Patty's, like, making her soup, and it was like, this is my dream life. What's happening?
Aubrey's like, how do you do this? And Patty's like, you're not conditioned.
Yeah.
And
was you're like, not tough enough.
Yeah. And was, like, helping her, like, you need to be drinking more water, and, like, being a surrogate mother in a weird way that is just the story we need, the content we need.
I needed that so much. And, yeah, I would also kill Liza. No disrespect to Liza. Yeah. It's just, yeah, the other two are higher. I was shocked to find out they are all very close in age.
Which I am also shocked. Well, I feel like Liza's had a little rougher of a life.
Mm-hmm. And, like, I feel like her entire life has been public, too. So we've, like, known about her longer.
Whereas Patty and Bernadette. Wow. But Bernadette, though, what is she, 75? And she's, like...
Yeah, I think she's 75. Patty's 74.
She's
Liza's
77. Old friends right now.
I know.
In London, and she's, like, killing it. And
right.
How old is Liza? 77?
77.
All right. Well,
yeah. Okay, our next category is Broadway Dreamboats, and we have Ramin Kerimlu, Jordan Fisher, and Jonathan Groff.
Okay, this one's tougher.
Yeah.
And I think I would marry Jordan Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he is just the nicest. Like, he strikes me as just, like, a really great person. Aside from being, like, very talented and just, I saw him do, I saw him in Evan Hansen. I didn't really know him. And is he a Nickelodeon? Is he?
I feel like he did some.
It's something, a Disney.
Youth show, Disney.
Like
a,
I feel like that's where I knew him from. And so often, like, well, sometimes you never know if these stars are really, like, can do Broadway. Cause it's a different beast. Jordan Fisher was so amazing as Evan Hansen.
Yeah.
And it was right before the pandemic also. And I was just blown away by his talent. And then he just seems like a great guy. And now he's at Hadestown. And he just... So I'd marry Jordan Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
He just seems like a really, really nice person.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's not, I don't need to know. Like, I want to keep that.
Nobody write in. Yeah.
I think I would date Jonathan Groff.
Mm-hmm.
So I do find him attractive. But I don't want to marry him because he's friends with Lea Michele.
Mm.
And that's a sort of a rough
that's a rough area.
And I again, hot take, I feel like, because Ramin is a you know, like a leading man.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't do it for me though.
Yeah.
It's but like oh that talent though. Hello.
Yeah.
Some is Valjean, and him just, like, belting those notes. It's like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then, like, ripped off his shirt, and he's like, Valjean with six packs.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, ho, ho.
That segues into my answer, which I would date Ramin Kerimlu, because I bought second row tickets to Les Mis so I could see him rip his shirt off.
Yeah, I understand.
And I remember hearing the fabric rip, and I was like, worth every penny. Perfect. But I don't think he's got a lot going on up there, so I don't think I'd want to marry him. I think this is a one-time thing. Enjoy the body, get out.
When I saw Evita, the Evita revival,
mm-hmm.
in 2012.
Is that the one with Ricky Martin in it?
Yes. And Ramin sat behind me and my friend, and I feel like he was a little cold. Honestly, I have no evidence to back any of this up. So, actually, you know what? I have no evidence to back any of that up, so...
That's what we're about here. Anyway. Wild accusations. So I would date Ramin. I would marry Jonathan Groff. I realize this is a sexless marriage because he's not buying what I'm selling.
Correct.
But I also love to look at him, especially right now because his hair is a little bit longer for Marilee. And I feel like we would just talk about Golden Age musicals all the time. And I could live a life like that.
I understand.
Yeah. And so by process of elimination, I could kill Jordan Fisher. Nothing personal. Yeah.
I understand. Sometimes. The tough questions.
That's just how it goes.
The tough questions.
Yeah, it would be a quick death if that helps at all. I'm not going to savor it. Yeah.
I guess.
Okay, and then our last category is a little bit different. We're doing Dearly Departed duets, in which at least half of the duet is now dead, in the spirit of Spring Awakening. So you have to date, marry, and kill these duets.
Oh, okay. I didn't understand this part of the... I just thought it was like, pick your favorite, and I was like, okay, got it.
Yeah, basically.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. Okay, so the options are Chita Rivera and Gwen Verdon performing Nowadays at the 1984 Tonys, Barbara Streisand and Judy Garland performing Get Happy, Happy Days Are Here Again on the Judy Garland Show in 1963, and Bea Arthur and Angela Lansbury performing Bosom Buddies at the 1988 Tonys.
Definitely marrying Bosom Buddies.
So good. I watched all of these again this week.
It's amazing. Yeah. Two of them are amazing. It's the rapport, it's the song, it's them just being sassy and getting away with it. It's just so perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I would kill Barbara and Judy. I've seen it. It doesn't do anything for me.
Mm-hmm.
And Nowadays is good too. Nowadays is good. Yeah, I would date them.
Yeah.
It would be enjoy that. And that one's more of a process of elimination sort of like thing.
Yes.
Of like just Bosom Buddies is absolutely, for me, miles in front of the other two.
Yeah.
Oh,
I would flip your last two. So I'm also marrying Bosom Buddies. I would date Happy Days because that's on my Watch When Sad video playlist. And then I'd have to get rid of Nowadays because I would like more dancing in that number, I think. I understand they're old by that point, but
yeah,
I want a little more movement.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah,
yes.
I understand.
Beautiful. Yeah, they don't even get to that part.
I know. Yeah. It's just them with the fedoras and
the kings. Yeah. All right. Well, do you have any media recommendations or anything they're watching, reading, listening to right now?
I don't listen to much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going through sort of some of my favorite plays. I'm reading some Albee again at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I just read Fragments. I don't know if you've read Fragments. It's
no.
a really lesser known one. I really love it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just reread a favorite play of mine called The Other Place by Char White,
Metcalf,
from the mid-2000s, I think.
Yeah.
And I recently, I'm a Playbill sort of addict of whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's sort of the main website where I get all my stuff from.
Yep.
And they have this great, it's I think we're only like 3 or 4 episodes in, but they have this great segment, I'm sure you've seen it, where they do this like day in the life thing, or life in the theater, that's what it's called. And so,
is that when they go through?
Yes.
Oh, I watched the Nathan Lane one.
Okay.
I haven't seen the rest yet, but
They are really, really good.
Yeah.
Because we don't often hear from, like, the people themselves.
Yeah.
And they're telling it like it is. There's the... Most are. There's one where the woman, like, just pretends... Like, we want the dirt, right?
Absolutely.
We want to hear the amazing experience you had, but also, like, come on, level with us.
Right.
Like,
not everything's a hit. Tell us.
You know,
yeah.
Like, Chip Zine's first thing he did, he played, like, a samurai, and he's like, and we... closed in a week. Like, you know, it was just like, we're like, come on, we want those sort of things. And
yeah.
We know, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. Sometimes
right.
we all want that. There was one of them where someone pretended like everything they had done was amazing. And I was like, okay.
That's just not
possible.
I
want Nathan Lane to tell us like the dirt behind Adam's Family.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But those are really cool because again, we don't often hear those sort of firsthand, not... you know, what is out in the media or not
yes.
in the, you know, the producers want us to hear, that sort of thing. First-hand accounts of, now that time has passed, about shows
yeah.
where we can hear the story of how things came to be. I think that's really, those are really cool. They're just like a half hour, but
yeah.
I'm like, worth it. Like,
yeah.
put on the, you know. Yeah. That's
okay.
all. That's all I got.
Good. Mine right now, I'm trying to watch, I got Letterboxd this year, so that's my new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm trying to watch 300 movies this year. I'm at 294, so we're almost there.
Oh my gosh,
yeah.
So close.
So I've discovered, I'm having a hard time with Christmas this year. I can't be with my family, they live far, and I'm just like not really getting into it. But I found that watching old movie musicals will give me sort of the same feeling that Christmas musicals are. So I'm trying to go through, I have like all those like TCM 4 movie things I haven't worked my way through yet.
Okay.
So I'm doing that. And I watched Summer Stock for the first time.
Oh, I've never this seen weekend. Stock.
It was so good. Like instant classic. Judy Garland, Gene Kelly, tap dancing on a farm. Can't go wrong.
Have you seen Summer Stock? I don't think so.
That's where Get Happy comes from, I think.
Okay, no. Oh, yeah. Yes, you're totally right. At no, the I end. Haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
I haven't seen. Around Christmas time, my family, first of all, The Sound of Music was on last week.
Oh, of course. You gotta.
Not really a. For whatever reason, it is a Christmas film.
I know.
Like, it has nothing to do with Christmas anywhere in the story, but.
It gives you that feeling, right?
Good.
Yeah,
oh.
Exactly.
But specifically, like Christmas films, we always do White Christmas.
Oh, I did watch White Christmas recently too. Yeah,
despite the fact that we are not having a White Christmas.
No, we're not.
And Meet Me in St. Louis.
Oh yeah.
Because again, only a part of it's Christmas, but it's like the great part.
Yeah.
Love that film.
Yeah.
Love it for its absurdity and for its. Like, just old... Just love it. Love it. Everything they're doing.
Yeah.
The way the wife is always like, listen, Lon. Like, she, you know, like, his name is Alonzo, and no one will call him Alonzo. And the youngest child is the girl playing Tootie is just, like, always at an 11.
Yes.
The way that they're eating, like, the biggest cake in the world... That what for like Halloween, they're like, let's have cake in our evening gowns at 9 p.m. What?
I'm going to start doing that. That sounds fun.
Or in the opening when they get back from playing tennis. Mm-hmm. And it's very hot, but they're dressed obviously in like full, you know, many layers that they had to be in, whatever. And you're like, how did you not pass it? Like, it's hot. It's hot in St. Louis. Anyway.
Yeah.
Those are the Christmas ones.
Excellent.
We always try to hit when it gets real close.
Yes. Fabulous. Well, Brian, thank you so much for being here with me.
No problem. It was so much fun.
Yes. Spring Awakening runs January 19th through the 28th at Slock Musical Theater in Schenectady. You can get tickets at slocktheater.org, and I believe immediately after we close, you have auditions for Into the Woods at Fort Salem Theater. So if you're interested in that, you can go to Fort Salem's website or social media for details.
FortSalem.com.
Wonderful. Well,
truly, the day after we close.
I saw that. I was like, whoa, right into it.
Yep.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you.
Theater Forks is hosted and produced by Amy Driscoll and Diana Shabai Booker. Our theme song is composed by Connor Walgus. Visit us at facebook.com/theaterforkspod, on Instagram @theaterforkspod, or email us at theaterforkspod@gmail.com.